The Murthy Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Teleconferences and podcasts were added to the resources available online in 2012. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording. Now, we are pleased to introduce attorney Sheila Murthy.
Hi, welcome. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. I'm so honored and delighted to welcome each of you today to attend this teleconference session with us on the topic of COVID-19 updates right through August of 2020. So obviously, as we all know, the 2020 pandemic has started impacting U.S. immigration with the shutdown of visa services, with border travel since mid-March or late March of this year. And although there is so much uncertainty as of August 2020, there are some updates to the different federal agencies involved with immigration. We'll discuss those updates with you. We'll talk about some possible strategies or issues to consider for you all as employers on how to deal with these challenges during the pandemic and the fallout and the ripple effect with the economic recession that has impacted most companies and businesses across the globe. Joining me for today's teleconference, I have my esteemed colleagues, Jessica Beaver and Kevin Andrews, who are going to have a lively discussion. We're hoping to have a lively discussion with you. And while it's not as interactive with questions and answers and surveys and polls, hopefully the interaction and the fun that we three are going to share with you is going to be something you feel, and we can also hopefully answer your questions as we're doing the discussion, because we're trying to understand based on our consultations and what we've seen, the kinds of issues that are being raised in our appointments. So with that, I want to get started with the CBP issues. So the CBP, or Customs and Border Protection, as most of you know, are dealing with the issues dealing with the two neighbors, Canada and Mexico. So for Canada and Mexico, we're seeing that they're only allowing essential travel with the land ports of entry since March 24th of 2020. We expect that to continue till at least August 20th of 2020. And we know that this could potentially continue because they've extended it multiple times so far. So a lot of lawyers and a lot of people have actually been saying, if it's, since the essential travel is meant for land ports of entry, does that mean I, as an individual, can fly and not have to deal with it? And the answer is most likely yes. By discussing with lawyers from across the country, it's our understanding that if you're flying between the U.S. and Canada or U.S. and Mexico, that the CBP at the port of entry, they're not being as strict, even pre-flight inspections are being allowed, and the essential travel requirement does not apply to you, for you, yourself, or your employees, or your family members. However, they've also clarified that essential travel includes travel by U.S. citizens and green card holders or lawful permanent residents who return back to the United States. And it could also be for people entering the U.S. for medical treatment, to attend university or school, to continue their education, as well as certain workers, whether it's healthcare workers, agricultural workers, and lawful cross-border trade like truck drivers delivering, because under the old NAFTA, under the new USMCA, U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which became effective actually from July, all of these issues are considered essential. All of these kinds of travel are considered essential travel, including government and military official travel. And you cannot now apply for a tourist visa to travel to those countries, purely for tourism purposes. But if you explain it's in order to attend a medical, educational institution, medical treatment, or I'm not even sure whether applying for a visa in order for me to be able to travel could potentially be arguably described as essential travel, it's something worth at least trying for till you either get denied, or it might depend on the officer or the particular port of entry, on the particular CBP headquarters. I also am sure many of you are aware that the global entry, which had been restricted for the state of New York, is now restarted since last month, July of 2020. And CBP has indicated that they will be much more flexible with respect to green card holders returning back to the United States if it's beyond the 180 days or in some cases beyond 360 days, though there is definitely some level of risk because the airlines may not allow you to board the aircraft. And even if you are allowed to board, that the CBP, either in that foreign country or CBP at the U.S. port of entry, might then either put you in removal proceedings if it's beyond the 1 year because there's a presumption of abandonment for a permanent resident, or in certain other cases, the airlines, as we said, may not allow you to board. But also, for those who are not aware, CBP does have discretion to admit people even without a visa at all or with a different kind of visa, as we know, under the automatic visa revalidation program that goes on, though it's not really a visa revalidation, where you can travel to Canada or Mexico for less than 30 days or less than 30 days and possibly re-enter even on a different visa as long as you have a I-94 approval, change of status within the U.S., and you have the requisite visa already in your passport, because as we just mentioned, visa is not going to be issued for tourism and travel generally. So that now brings us to the next issue that CBP has to deal with, which is, of course, the presidential proclamation of the more recent one applicable for employment-based H-1B, H-2B, L-1s, and J-1s, which is the presidential proclamation of June 22nd of 2020, which became effective from June 24th of 2020. And it was amended, as you all know, a week later on June 29th. Basically, under the presidential proclamation, the executive order, it is effective and was effective from June 24th. It goes on until December 31st. It basically makes it clear that it impacts those who are outside of the United States on the effective date of the proclamation itself. So technically, if you were in the United States and you now have to travel abroad because of a family emergency, the way the proclamation is written and the way the U.S. Department of State has issued a clarification, you should be exempt or your employee should be exempt and not be prevented from traveling and coming back if they already have the visa and the passport. If they need to apply for a visa at the consulate, of course, you have a much bigger issue because many consular posts in many countries, including a country like India, are obviously closed and shut down because of the global pandemic. So if you don't have a visa, you're going to have a potential problem unless you try to get the visa waiver, the 212A7 documentary waiver requirements approved by CBP, which is discretionary. So for the proclamation to apply, you have to be outside the United States on the effective date of the proclamation, first. Second, you don't have a non-immigrant visa in the category which is suspended entry, which we just said is H-1B, H-2B, L-1, and J-1, certain J-1, not all J-1s, which we'll get into in a minute, that you don't have it in that particular category that you're seeking to enter the United States, and that it needs to be valid as on the effective date. So if you had a visa, but the visa, let's say, unfortunately expired on June 23rd, but now this is only effective from June 24th, you didn't have it valid on the effective date. So they're saying that it will apply to you because now you're asking to apply and obtain a new visa on the effective date in the category and choosing to enter on that particular category. Third, if you don't have an official travel document, if you have an advance parole, a boarding foil, a transportation letter, or a visa, then you could still re-enter the United States. And as we explained, the H-1B, H-2B, L-1, and J-1s, but the J-1s, it's like the au pair, the camp counselors, the interns, the summer work travel teacher and trainee programs. It doesn't apply to the medical doctors, J-1s, and their dependents, of course. If you're exempt, your dependent is also exempt. And that was a clarification that was issued by Department of State after the presidential proclamation, which was a very big source of relief because the H-1 dependent spouses who were stuck abroad could potentially now apply for the visa if the principal on the H-1B was in the United States from the effective date of this proclamation, when it was effective from June 24th. So we've gone over everything very, very quickly. So I think the way that we can try is to see if a person can be exempt and enjoy one of the exemptions. And for this, I am going to invite my esteemed colleague, Kevin Andrews, to join me and to explain who are exempt from the from all of these restrictions of the proclamation. Kevin?
Thank you, Sheila. Real quick, before the exemptions, I just wanted to touch on something that you had mentioned about the H-dependent spouse clarification, because I got a couple of different variations of that, and I just kind of wanted to share that. So one was, well, what's the situation if somebody is here with an approved H-1B petition with a start date of October 1 with the I-94 card approved, but this particular individual, his spouse, they're already married, his spouse is abroad, and she's pregnant, and she's due in October, November, something like that. So can she apply for the visa? Because he was physically here as of June 22nd, but he was not in H-1 status. He was in F-1, you know, with an approved H-1B. So my thought on this is that after October 1, when he automatically enters into H-1B status, assuming visa operations reopen, that the executive order would not apply to his spouse in that scenario. Did you guys have any thoughts about that?
I sort of agree. Look, first of all, if you don't make the argument, you have nothing to hang your hat on. And so I think it's absolutely correct to say, first of all, F1s are not impacted. So clearly the spouse right now on the F2, if she wants to enter before having the baby or after having the baby, I guess that's the other question. But let's say either situation, clearly she can apply as soon as the consulate's open. If she already has the F2, she can re-enter now on the F2 right away. The F2 visa stamp in her passport and based on her principal spouse being on the F1. And if she's trying to come in after October 1st, when his H-1B status becomes effective and operational, then, yeah, because he's physically in the United States, he's on H-1B status, and the spouse should be eligible to apply. As we said, the practical consideration, of course, is the consulates are not open. Yeah, you're allowed to apply for the visa, but now you have to fly to some other country which may be open, but they may be only taking their country nationals and not the TCNs or third country nationals. And there's
right, you
got to
deal with the logistics. Of course, you got to deal with the logistics of the post, but not the executive order. That was the easier one, I thought, that I got. So what do you guys think about this one? Real quickly, H-1B and H-4 family are both here in the U.S. H-1 is approved, but the H-4 is pending like they all are. EAD is getting ready to expire, and they need that job to put food on the table for the family. Can the H-4 travel out and apply for the visa and not be subject to the executive order because the H-1 spouse was physically in the U.S. at the time? I'm thinking that one is a little bit more no, but what do you guys think about that one?
No, I think actually you said both of them are in the U.S. right now, correct?
It's just that in the second variation, the individual's leaving the U.S. to apply for the H-1B visa. Yes, I'm sorry, the H-4 visa. Yes, their spouse was physically in the U.S., but they're leaving to apply for the visa. I mean, I think that would want
to contact
close
clearly,
first,
to me, there's, in fact, it's even cleaner than the first one because they weren't even, both of them are exempt because it only applies to people who were outside of the United States on the effective date of the order. So if they were both physically in the U.S., according to what Department of State issued its clarification, both of them are exempt from the restrictions of the presidential proclamation / executive order of June 24th. So both can apply. Again, it's only logistics. Is the consulate open for the person to travel and come back, get onto H-4? But the person, it's not still going to help the person because they still have to apply for the EAD and wait. Though, as we know from the lawsuits, I guess they could sue, join that lawsuit demanding issuance of the H-4 EAD because this is a ruse by the current administration to purposefully delay H-4 EAD issuance because they couldn't issue regulations to deny or stop H-4 EAD regulations because they would have to go through the regulatory process of the Administrative Procedures Act. So they are basically delay so that H-4 EADs cannot work in the United States. So I would actually think that second one is a much more straightforward issue for both of them to apply for the
We're definitely going to see how the rubber hits the road in the next couple of months as visa, as consular operations reopen. So, yeah, with the exemptions that was already clarified in the initial proclamation, definitely does not apply to lawful permanent residents or the spouse or child of a U.S. citizen. It does not apply to individuals that are providing labor that's essential to the U.S. supply chain, food supply chain. National interest exemptions are available through the Secretary of State, through State Department. And it also, besides those exemptions, something else that it expanded was, or the time frame expanded was that immigrant visa ban from earlier this year that banned the issuance of the immigrant visas abroad. There are exceptions that still apply to certain EB-5 and EB-5 petitions and also spouses and children of U.S. citizens, but that executive order has been extended. And as we discussed earlier, and as everybody knows, you know, visa services globally has frozen since the beginning of the pandemic in mid-March. But as of July 15th, some operations throughout the planet have started to reopen. And I've seen some limited things like Austria and some limited, you know, places here and there, certainly not India or the high volume posts that we're used to seeing a lot of volume come through. So that's going to be a slow turn of the knob, I think, to get those services operational again, which is when we'll see the rubber, how the rubber hits the road on a lot of these things we were just discussing. And then finally, State Department announced recently that the Center for Disease Control approved a one-month extension for medical examinations that are conducted between January 1st and June 30th of this year. So just, you know, providing some logistical relief there. So those are the updates for State Department.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Kevin. And before I ask Jessica to start talking about the Department of Labor updates with respect to COVID-19 operations, I just want to say that in a lot of the consultations that I've done, a question often asked is, well, I might be, you know, doing some stuff connected with agricultural production, food production, or the research I'm doing or the work I'm doing directly or indirectly with the company I'm working. We are based, you know, in a healthcare facility that's helping COVID-19. And so the issue, of course, is can I fall within one of the exemptions? And the suggestion and the idea always is, look, if you can do it, why not? Why not make an attempt, put in the application, do what you need to do in order to ensure that you can make a really good, strong argument about how you can fit into the exemption by showing that your work will be in the national interest of the United States because you're providing temporary labor essential to either to the U.S. food supply chain, as well as medical research and ways how to fight COVID-19. Just do it. Whatever you can hang your hat on, absolutely go for it. So with that, I'm going to invite my esteemed colleague, Jessica Beaver, to jump in and explain the U.S. Department of Labor updates with respect to what's happening with COVID-19 in this era.
Sure. Thanks, Sheila. As many of you know, Department of Labor has remained pretty fully functional during this entire pandemic period. For H-1Bs, we were able to get labor condition applications. For labor certifications, we were able to get prevailing wages. Still file labor certifications. Initially, when the outbreak sort of came to the U.S., the Department of Labor did allow certain extensions till May 12th of 2020 for some of the advertisements, and they did produce a frequently asked question about it. However, they have said that there are no more extensions. Prevailing wage determinations cannot be extended. Recruitment cannot be extended. So it's really business as usual. One of the things that has come up during this sort of time for business as usual is we've now, since March, been getting these electronic perm labor certifications by email, and the Department of Labor has said that they're going to extend that through at least September 30th, 2020. Also, the new form of the ETA 9089 form has been proposed, and it's right now available for public comment, and should go into effect into the fall if it passes through notice and comment. During this time period, we've seen new audit language that asks employers about business necessity for the position in the labor certification, as well as ownership of the entity and if their employee being sponsored owns the company, as well as if there is sufficient full-time work. One of the sort of questions that a lot of practitioners had during this time period that Department of Labor really didn't address through a frequently asked question was about the notice of filing that's required for perm cases, because by regulation it has to be physically posted for 10 days and doesn't have an electronic exception like H-1B petitions do. However, in the recent July 2020 AILA conference, American Immigration Lawyers Association, the Department of Labor did confirm that the notice of filing for perm cases can actually be satisfied by posting on an exterior door or front entry, even if the workplace is 100% closed and employees are 100% remote, so long as the business is operational. Department of Labor did say they're not going to issue a frequently asked question, but they did also indicate that it's not in their practice to ask in an audit, you know, prove how many workers were working remote versus in the office, all of that. So if you have your notice of filing and you've posted for the 10 business days by regulation, and that's key, is the 10 business days, so the business has to be operational, even if people are working remotely, then you've met those requirements. So unlike some of the other things that we've talked about that are, you know, being impacted during this time, the Department of Labor pretty much has been able to, continue to process cases. They've said a lot of their workers are also working remotely, as well as those of us that are also working remotely can file cases online, file prevailing wages online. It's a very becoming a very electronic-friendly system. And
Jess, I just want to ask real quick.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Jess. I just want to ask real quick, has the processing times changed since the pandemic?
We haven't really seen the processing times change as much. I would say right now, as of this recording, we're seeing prevailing wages come in about 4 months, and we're seeing labor certifications without audit come in about 4 to 5 months, and sort of if you get the audit, sort of an additional 4 to 5 months. The Department of Labor did say at that AILA conference, however, due to budget constraints, due to workload, they do anticipate that the times, you know, can get longer. So we'll just have to kind of wait to see what happens. But as of now, everything's sort of been running the same as it did pre-pandemic world. And
great.
With the Department of Labor, like I said, they haven't had a lot of changes, but we have seen some changes with the USCIS. Sheila, what have you seen with the USCIS in terms of changes?
Great. Thank you so much, Jessica. I appreciate the opportunity. And it's, I guess, a silver lining in the dark cloud during COVID-19 that at least one federal agency is continuing its operations more or less largely unimpacted by COVID-19. They've been a little flexible in allowing the signatures, you know, the wetting signatures and scan and copies of all of that. And it's also interesting that the one main organization whose job it is to protect the U.S. labor force, even before Buy American, Hire American and all of that, is the one agency that is actually chugging along and being most productive and most helpful in making this immigration process while protecting the U.S. labor force and protecting jobs for U.S. workers. So be that as it may, with respect to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, as we all know, starting from early June 4th of 2020 to be precise, some of the USCIS field offices and the asylum offices actually had started to resume non-emergency face-to-face services to the public. Each local office has its own pandemic procedure. So if you're working in a particular office, your employees are affected by or need to go for an interview, whether it's a green card interview for the 485 or the citizenship interview for yourself or your employees, you should feel free to contact or go to the website of that particular USCIS office before physically going in there, because right now the process and procedure actually requires that every single USCIS office now requires that any person, any child over the age of 2, and every adult has to wear a face mask. They are limiting who can actually attend interviews. Even attorneys are primarily being invited to participate by telephone. And so the client has to take the telephone number with them and then has to call the person during the interview and insist on it, because some officers apparently are not loving it. Same thing for interpreters. It can be by phone. And sometimes parents or guardians, if it's a minor child, and immediate family members on an application, or to assist a disabled person, but even naturalization ceremonies for citizenship, you cannot have any guests attending, whereas before, you know, family members would come in and everybody would sort of raise their right hand when the national anthem is being played. It was a very special moment in your life. Well, that's no longer an option. I'm sure some of you watched on TV how they are, some state USCIS offices are having drive-through naturalizations by allowing people to drive through with masks and with, you know, the face shields, and then handing over the actual citizenship certificate to the people while they're driving through. We've also seen biometric appointments, which is fingerprints, et cetera, that they have started to resume as of the middle of July, but it is being done on a phased approach and they're being very strict. So the person's only allowed to go in on the day and time requested, unlike before where you could go if you were out abroad traveling, you couldn't make it. They would be very flexible, not any longer. InfoPass appointments to go meet with an officer are available only for emergency reasons. As most of you know in this call, the premium processing has resumed, which wasn't available initially when the during the CAP filing season. But one important point I thought would be important to mention is the Texas Service Center location actually moved, and it was happening right in the middle towards the end of when the CAP, H-1B CAP filing season was going on. So ensure that the H-1B petitions, not the CAP ones, because that, of course, the window closed on that on June 30th, but all other CAP petitions, H-1B petitions for extensions, changes of employer, changes of job, amendments, et cetera, are now filed with the correct address. We also have seen, as all of you may be aware, both the I-551, which is green cards, and the EAD card 765, there have been extensive, unusually long delays. Sometimes before it used to take 3 months, then it increased to 6 months, and now it's taking 6 months to a year or longer to produce them. There's, as I mentioned earlier, lawsuits that have been filed and are in the process of being filed, writs of mandamus. Even Murthy Law Firm has already been involved with some of those. And the truth is, unfortunately, the minute you file these lawsuits, most of the cases you are winning because the government knows very often that what they're doing is improper. The judge is going to slap them on the wrist because they are trying to do in practice and process what they cannot do by issuing new regulations or going through the administration, you know, following the rules for how to issue new regulations. As I mentioned earlier, USCIS is still accepting scanned signature pages, so no marks, no electronic signatures. It has to be a proper ink signature that is being scanned and sent in. So fax copies are required, unfortunately. I know it's outdated for some of you, but that's the way it works. And with respect to the 60-day extension that was granted for RFCs, notice of intentions to deny, NOIDs, NOIRs, notice of intentions to revoke, motions to reopen, N14s, et cetera, they've extended it until, don't ask me why they came up with this date, doesn't make sense, but I think they're trying to make a point, September 11th of 2020. And with respect to the policy manual update, with respect to discretion, we know that there have been delays and the issuance of EAD cards and green cards, and we've been told that what was previously considered a no-brainer, just a ministerial administrative act, is now possibly going to be impacted with the USCIS officers seeking discretion. I'm sure you've also heard about the furloughs that have that the USCIS threatened to start effective from Monday, August the 3rd of 2020. But then when one of the senators, U.S. senators, said, but how come? First of all, you're supposed to be paid by filing fees. You're not dependent on tax revenues, and you're supposed to be fully self-funded. And second of all, your budget is showing that you have a surplus that will show you successful through till end of September. They decided to push it from August 3rd to September 3rd or till end of September possibly, because there's already a surplus in their budget. So we'll have to see what happens with that. If the furloughs do kick into effect with 70% of USCIS workforce not being able to work, then obviously that will further delay processes and approvals and EADs and H1s, et cetera. Sounds like we need to definitely enforce our rights. We need to do whatever it takes. Also, two very, very exciting developments with the USCIS rescind a couple of H1B memos. I'm going to invite Kevin Andrews to come back to explain and describe that.
Thank you, Sheila. So yeah, there's been a lot of procedural updates, and on top of that, some significant policy changes. These policy changes hopefully are positive developments. So there was a lawsuit, IT Serve Alliance v. USCIS, which resulted in a district court case that where the lawsuit, you know, confirmed that USCIS's application of their policy memo from February of 2018 was a violation of law. And, you know, one of the things that they looked at was the exponential increase in the denial rate from 2015 and 16 to, you know, 2018, 2019, and until now, something like a 5 to 6% denial rate to a 20 to 40% denial rate in just a few years. And, you know, to say that the memo was interpreting law, but at the same time seeing these substantive changes, the court wasn't buying it. So part of the settlement agreement was USCIS actually didn't just apply to the plaintiffs in that case, but USCIS rescinded not just the February 2018 policy memo, but also the preceding January 2010 memo that started this whole right to control fiasco. So the regulation here says that the employer-employee relationship is defined by the employer's ability to hire, fire, pay, or otherwise control. And I think what we've been dealing with since at least 2010 was USCIS saying, well, we think of it as hire, fire, pay, and otherwise control. And that's the foundation upon these, you know, on which these two memos were built, and now those memos have been removed. The June 2020 policy memo that replaces them seems to have, you know, the least bites, I guess. But we have to kind of see, because it's still kind of vague, the language that's there. But I think that it's a hopeful kind of some optimism here that perhaps the documentation of the employer-employee relationship can be satisfied with things that are a little bit more reasonable than, you know, showing the entire contract and purchase order and a detailed letter saying all these things that's just kind of seems to be beyond the standard of proof that's applicable to this administrative proceeding. So I think, you know, I've been getting a lot of questions about, you know, what this means, but, you know, we're doing this teleconference for August, and the memo came out in June, and this is another one of those, you know, I'm not really seeing how the rubber is hitting the road, but I feel more confident in submitting petitions for initial filing that, you know, don't have all of these things, because the February 2018 memo was threatening to, you know, kind of deny the petitions without an RFE if you don't satisfy these heightened standards. So I'm feeling like, you know, the direction that things are moving is away from the ledge and not towards it. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
Yeah, Kevin, I think, first of all, most of the people are already, you know, most of the people on this call, I'm sure there are hundreds, if not thousands, of IT consulting company or IT store members that are part of today's teleconference as well. And so they're certainly familiar with the memos. And we're certainly seeing fewer RFEs. And the government certainly has acknowledged that they are, that they above and beyond what they were supposed to, which for them was a big deal because they were getting lawsuits across the country on these issues. And from all of the employers we're hearing from, we have definitely seen that there's far fewer RFEs already in place. Jessica, were you also trying to say something?
I was just going to mention that we have seen some of our CAT petitions, especially those that have been upgraded to premium processing, we've seen them get three-year duration approvals without an RFE. So we are seeing that. Not to say that, you know, some aren't going to get an RFE, but we have seen approvals for the first time in a long time for a three-year duration without a request for evidence.
Okay,
yeah, so
and
one thing,
go ahead.
Yeah, one thing I've been kind of like thinking about with all this development is, you know, this coupled with the fact that you can't just leave and apply for a visa and come back if a petition is denied anymore. You know, it's not the inconvenience of a international trip. It's an existential thing about whether or not you can keep your job, perhaps. So, you know, a lot of, and I know we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but a lot of individuals are saying, well, I want to, you know, file a late-filed H-1B petition. And, you know, if the basis for the status violation is not directly related to COVID-19, it's directly related to the fact that the petition was denied because they said no right to control or whatever, thinking about this argument that, but for that denial would not have happened post June 2020 because they were applying the February 2018 memo in, you know, February or March or April, whenever, when they denied the petition. Had they been applying the June 2020 memo, which confirmed the unlawful nature of these previous policy memos, they would have maintained status. So the failure to maintain status was due to the extraordinary circumstance of USCIS improperly denying the petition, which they're admitting as of June. And it's only been exacerbated by the fact that there's a pandemic now. So I'm thinking about this as like an NPT argument that's like, it's not directly related to COVID-19, but COVID is part of it. And the main proximate cause of the status violation is, you know, USCIS sort of kind of indirectly admitting that they adjudicated the petition incorrectly because of this development. What do you guys think?
I think it's a great, it's a wonderful concept. It's creative, it's aggressive, it's proactive. It's the philosophy of the Murthy Law Firm to always fight hard and do whatever we can to, within the framework of the law and following all the legal and ethical rules, to ensure that we can do a good job proactively. And I love it. I think it's fantastic and the way we should go. Jessica, did you have anything to add to that?
I was just going to mention that also, you know, unfortunately, there are situations like layoffs that happen in this, you know, sort of turbulent time. So what Kevin was saying is, you know, when it comes to allowing USCIS to receive a petition sort of filed late, remember, first of all, you have the 60-day grace period or until the end of your I-94, whatever is first, to file the H-1B change of status or to change status if need be. The USCIS also had the news release in March that basically recognized that there are immigration-related challenges as a direct result of the coronavirus pandemic. So like Kevin was saying, you have to show the delay was due to extraordinary circumstances. So the pandemic could be an extraordinary circumstance. However, USCIS is cautioning people that the length of the delay must be commensurate with the circumstance. So if the circumstance happened in March, you know, filing in August may not be commensurate with the circumstance, for example. But from that March sort of release, they are sort of accepting those late filings to argue that it was beyond their control due to extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, Jess, also, there's I get situations also where people are saying, well, look, I'm coming up on the 60 days, and, you know, I just bumped into Elon Musk or whatever, and there's this cool job offer at Tesla, or I'm making this up, but you know what I mean? They only agreed to start the petition, and I'm at day, you know, 57. I can't get it done within the 60 days. Should I file the change of status to B and then have them file it and then I can't work, or just wait until it's, you know, the day 65 or 73 or whatever and file it and then make the argument that it's extraordinary circumstances, not so much under the 60-day grace period because I'm at day 70 or whatever it is, but under just broadly extraordinary circumstances beyond my control. You know, I think that's a tough thing that partially people have to answer, like, well, who do I have to feed and what mortgages do I have to pay, you know, to answer that question. But I think it's a viable strategy to still do. What do you guys think?
If it's a good faith, timely files application or petition, you have a really good reason, you can explain it. Look, there's, like you said, if you switch to B, you can't work. If you sort of left it at H1 to H1 under the H1B portability provisions of AC21 law, you can now switch from employer A to employer B by filing this new petition. Great. I think we should, I think if the employer and the employee both understand that there is a level of risk because we're asking for a discretionary relief with a non-pro-tunk argument, then let's go ahead and do it. Because to me, if I was the employer or the employee, I would absolutely prefer that to being told that this B2 could take 8 to 10 months, and then if I'm switching from a B2 and H, I can't work. And now with consulates closed and with a global pandemic, I can't take a 24-hour flight or 20-hour flight to fly halfway across the world only to get either a disease, which is far more troubling than actually just losing a job and not being able to pay a mortgage or eat. So now you have multiple levels of complexity and life-threatening issues to have to deal with. So my philosophy is, go ahead, give it a shot. If all of you understand that there is some level of thing, and if the USCIS risk here, and if USCIS refuses to approve the case, you at least had a good faith, timely good faith filing that was not timely, and that's why you're making the non-proton argument that because of COVID-19, you lost your job in the first place, and so it wouldn't have happened but for the whole economy and the whole world going into this tizzy and, you know, going downhill, so to speak. And I don't think any one person is to necessarily blame for some factors that are outside our control, but we all still have to comply with the rules, laws, and regulations, and we're all bound by those.
I think it's also important to remind, if it came up with USCIS, if you hypothetically were filing a case late after the 60 days, the 60-day regulation that came into effect in January of 17 is what enabled that regulation was the broader extraordinary circumstances regulation. So in other words, they said, oh, you know, this regulation, HCFR 214.1C4, that says extraordinary circumstances, yada, yada. Well, we're making this new regulation starting January of 17 that says if it's filed within 60 days of a layoff or resignation, we automatically consider that an extraordinary circumstance. So if I'm filing this on day 67, I know that I'm not precisely qualifying under the 60-day regulation, but I am more broadly qualifying under the foundational regulation upon which that 60-day reg is built off of. And, you know, coupled, so I guess what I'm trying to say in more broader basic terms is I know it's a 60-day regulation, but you should give me a few days because of the pandemic.
Sure. It's a great argument to make. I just need to watch. I know we're for about 44 minutes, and we always try to do this between 30 and 45 minutes, and we're at 44 minutes right now. So I don't know if you want to try to slowly try to wrap up. I know there's a little bit that we want to talk about people working remotely or work from home policies and what the LCA and those requirements are. If one of you wants to just briefly touch upon it, and then we can wrap up with the ICE and SEVP policies.
Just real briefly, the you know, the LCA. If you're working from home, you need to post the new LCA notice at the home location before working at that location. So this is going to apply where the work is being done at an in-house location. So I'm working for the company, and then I have to work from home. The LCA needs to be posted at the home location as long as home is within normal commuting distance of the original location. If so, an amendment is not required. If the individual's home is outside the normal commuting distance, it's going to change the wage data. That an amendment is required for that individual, and really the only flex time that you have is it should be filed before the change occurs, but you have a 30-day window to make an argument that it was a short-term placement that, you know, became more permanent as the pandemic progressed or regressed. And another question I get very often is, well, what if I'm working at an end client and, you know, things are changing, the market is volatile, I got to move to another end client down the street that's within normal commuting distance, right? I'm not so sure that that's not something that requires an amendment. I don't think USCIS ever specifically commented on that. There's this case matter, Simeo Solutions, that says if the new work location is within normal commuting distance, it's not a material change. But they didn't talk about whether there's also a change in client. And because this administration is asking for things like contracts and purchase orders and letters when the client changes, I think, you know, they would perceive it to be a material change. So the conservative approach would be to file the amendment, though I can't say that it's specifically, you know, required.
Let's move to jump to ICE and SEVP since we're sort of past the time. We'll just try to wrap up in the next 2 or 3 minutes. I know we're running just a couple minutes past our time. I know with some of you, a lot of you may be hiring F1 STEM OPT students, F1 OPT students, and so student issues are clearly of some interest to most of you as employers, but the universities or the designated school officials / international student advisors have been told that they cannot issue a new form I-20 for a student to basically start a fresh, brand new initial F1 status if the person is outside of the United States and only plans to take full online courses only. On the other hand, if the student plans to do part-time online and part-time in-person, or what they refer to in the university setting as hybrid education with both in-person and online, then that's perfectly allowed for the person to get in the I-20 with the notation made clearly on what they're doing, because both for the visa application at the consulate to obtain the F1 visa standing and to allow the person with CBP to enter the United States, those are questions the student needs to be prepared to explain and answer. Of course, for those who were enrolled already in a university program in a course of study as of March 9th of 2020. And why that date is important is because that was the date the previous rules were explained. But then after that, the student actually left the United States. Such a person most likely is eligible to obtain if they need a visa, but they really should have already obtained the visa for the four-year or the two-year degree, the four-year undergrad degree or the two-year master's degree, because the March guidance permitted full online course of study for such students who were already previously enrolled. So it's only for the new students who are not eligible to enter to start course. And CBP was very aware of it when we had our discussion with them through the American Immigration Lawyers Association's annual conference last week, which is the first ever virtual conference that they had. And those non-immigrant students who are already on F1 status or M1 status can continue to remain in the United States to continue to engage in a full course of study online because they didn't want to interrupt or disrupt. That was the Harvard and MIT lawsuit with literally hundreds of other universities filing amicus briefs to express their serious concerns if they were now suddenly having to change their processes and procedures after having, you know, notified students and issued policies. So since we're well past the point, I want to briefly conclude that obviously these are unprecedented times, that for you all as employers, for us as attorneys, we need to think creatively, we need to be nimble. We need to obviously continue to comply with U.S. immigration laws and regulations, but when they're wrong, they absolutely need to be challenged with lawsuits because we've seen each time you sue, you win. And so don't hesitate, don't be afraid, don't be scared. I know this year is an election year in November, so please, if immigration is an important issue for you as an employer, as an issue, then keep that in mind when you're making decisions. And it's true that we now have in fact, even on Mufti.com, we have a lot of the information on the presidential proclamation, other issues dealing with each of these topics in much greater detail, both, I think, on YouTube and on Mufti Law Firm website, through podcasts, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to say that on behalf of Jessica Bieber, Kevin Andrews, myself, Sheila Mufti, and our entire Mufti Law Firm team, we thank you for joining us for today's teleconference, and we look forward to continuing to empower, enlighten, educate, and guide you all as the rules continue to change. And as always, it will be an honor and a pleasure for us to continue to serve you and serve you as employers, as businesses, and your employees as you navigate complex and ever-changing rules. Have a wonderful afternoon. Stay safe, stay healthy. Until next month. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Mufti Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.mufti.com.